Well, thank you, Mr. Summers. And again, thanks to the outstanding choir and their director. Very enjoyable piece, as was mentioned. Don't Worry About the Drive Home, I think was the title of that song. Something like that. Well done. We appreciate the effort that's gone into that. Since we're talking about music, I'm going to ask a question about how many of you remember a song by the title of Hard-Hearted Hannah? You remember that? Ooh, mostly very gray heads remember that one. That dates a little bit. Hard-Hearted Hannah was a song I became familiar with in the 1970s because some ingenious person rewrote the song as an arrangement for a barbershop quartet. So, we sang Hard-Hearted Hannah. Hard-Hearted Hannah was written in 1927. That's a long time ago. So the song's been around a long time. Now you say, well, that's an old song, but it has been re-recorded probably 100 times because of the unique lyrics that it has. Mostly, it's a cute melody, but the lyrics really are what does it. They seem to be timeless. So the song was most recently recorded in 2010, again, by another artist. Artists like Ella Fitzgerald have done them in the past. Some of the old-timers will remember that. But I thought I would go through, as an introduction for the sermon, a bit about the lyrics of Hard-Hearted Hannah for those who aren't familiar with it. Hard-Hearted Hannah is about a woman named Hannah who has a hard heart. That pretty much says the title. It goes like this. In old Savannah, I said, Savannah, the weather there is nice and warm. The climate's of a southern brand. But here's what I don't understand. They got a gal there, a pretty gal there, who's colder than an Arctic storm. Got a heart just like a stone. Even icemen leave her alone. They call her Hard-Hearted Hannah, the vamp of Savannah, the meanest gal in town. Leather is tough, but Hannah's heart is tougher. She's a gal who likes to see men suffer. To tease them and thrill them, to torture and kill them is her delight, they say. I saw her at the seashore with a great big pan. There was Hannah pouring water on a drowning man. She is Hard-Hearted Hannah, the vamp of Savannah, GA. They call her Hard-Hearted Hannah, the vamp of Savannah, the meanest gal in town. Talk about your cold, refrigerated mamas. Brother, she's a polar bear's pajamas. To tease him and thrill him, to torture and kill him is her delight, they say. An evening spent with Hannah sitting on your knees is like traveling through Alaska in your BVDs. She is Hard-Hearted Hannah, the vamp of Savannah, the vamp of Savannah, GA. Hannah was a cold woman. Now, about the same time, you think of sometimes opera being a very old thing. Halfway around the world in Italy, there was an individual writing about another cold-hearted woman. How many of you might be familiar with the opera Turandot? Anyone? A few of us. Turandot's a fascinating story. It was written by Puccini, Giacomo Puccini, Italian guy, spoke Italian even. You might remember a bit about Turandot. The scene is set in the Far East. Turandot is the princess, the single beautiful princess. And she, of course, as princess, is supposed to be married off to someone, but she does not want to be married. So, any prince who comes as a suitor and wants to marry Turandot has to come to the city square, and there's a giant gong in the square. And he bangs that gong 3 times to let Turandot know that he would like to marry her. And in order to be able to marry Turandot, you have to answer 3 deep, dark riddles. And suitor after suitor cannot answer the riddles. And of course, the challenge is, if you can't answer the riddles, what happens? Remember what the Queen of Hearts does? off with their head. That's what happens. You're put to death if you can't answer the three questions. So she is known as an ice-cold woman as well. Now, it's interesting because the star, of course, the male, who comes in as a prince and he's going to win her heart, rings the gong three times against everyone's advice. Don't do it, you'll die. He rings the gong and sure enough goes through this trouble of can he possibly answer these questions and marry this cold woman. Now why would he want to marry this cold-hearted woman, Turandot? Well, it's because she's so beautiful and he's smitten with her. So it's a real deep, you know, subject. Yeah, I want to marry a woman who's cold as ice and kills everyone who tries to date her. That's my idea of fun. So nonetheless, he rings the gong three times. He comes through the story to the three questions. And I won't give you the questions or the answers because you may want to go see the opera sometime. And of course, it's in Italian, so you wouldn't understand a bit of it. But nonetheless, he is able to answer the three questions. And she is just crestfallen. She begs her father, don't make me marry him. And he said, look, it's the law. He answered the questions. You have to marry him. And of course, some of you might remember then, one of the most famous tenor arias of all time. He actually says, if you can learn my name before sunrise, then you can kill me. And she works very hard. He sings the famous aria, Nessun dorma, let no one sleep until morning, because they want to find out what the name is. Well, of course, she can't find out and she's forced to marry him. But at sunrise, he sees that she is so disheartened that he really realizes that marriage to this woman would not be much fun. So he tells her, I will tell you my name and then you decide whether I live or die. And as he's about to tell her his name, he plants a big one on her. And that kiss, that embrace melts Turandot's heart. And he tells her the name and they go before the whole village and she announces, I know his name and his name is Love. That's not his real name, but of course, she's in love with him now. He's in love with her. They're married and live happily ever after is the idea. Well, now that I've given you the whole cats out of the bag opera, what would you say is the problem for Hannah, and what was the problem for Turandot? What was their problem? Well, I think we could say pretty clearly their problem was they were women. Just kidding. Just kidding. I just lost half the audience right there. Gone for the rest of the day. Just teasing about that. I would submit to you the problem for these two women at this point in their lives was that they were calloused. They were hardened. Now, there may be good reason sometimes for being hardened, but they were calloused. What do I mean, calloused? The American College Dictionary defines calloused this way: hardened, hardened in mind, or in feelings. Do you think Turandot, as she had each of those men executed, had any sympathy toward them? Not at all. Think Hannah did at all in her fictional setting? No, not at all. Synonyms for calloused are hardened, insensitive, unfeeling. Now, as we go through these synonyms, I think we'll begin to see there is spiritual value in examining this concept. Indifferent, cold, cool, unemotional, unsympathetic, heartless, unresponsive, unfeeling, detached, uninterested, distant, unsocial, apathetic, or uncaring. All those are various symptoms to try to help us understand what it means to be calloused. Today, during the course of the sermon, what I'd like to do is address this topic of callousness to see if we have become, as members of the family of God, somewhat hardened, somewhat calloused. And if so, what we might be able to do about it. You see, if we're going to teach others the truths of God, which is our ultimate destiny, to be able to share the truths of God with those individuals in the world tomorrow who are teachable, with those individuals in the world today who become teachable, if we are to share what we understand and hold so dear, it must be done with a lack of callousness. Because if we're callous, we really won't care. We won't care if people are converted or not. We don't care if the gospel is effective or not. It really doesn't matter to us one way or the other. So how might we know if we've become calloused? How might we know? What signs might there be that could indicate? Now you can think of a number of things. You might meditate this on this or pray about this later in the week. But nonetheless, here's a few things I've jotted down to help stimulate some thinking. How about this? Remembering when we hear or receive over the email a prayer request update that we had not even prayed for the person in the first place. Why would that be? Have we become insensitive to their suffering, to their needs, to their struggle? How about feeling little or no emotion when hearing of others' hardships or tragedies? No, sorry. Sorry about that, but it doesn't really affect us. It doesn't hit us. How about when seeing another's hardships or tragedies, we have the overwhelming feeling, most of all, well, I'm glad it's not me, instead of feeling with the person, feeling for the person or the people? How about not taking time to really listen to others? Someone starts to open up about what they're struggling with, what they're dealing with, what they've been through. And we're looking at our watch wondering when we can get away and on to other things. Is that a possible sign? I don't know. Some of those things you can think about. How about not serving others, being so wrapped up in our own lives that we just don't think of others and how we might help them, what we could be doing for them? How about easily looking down on the sins of others, racking them up in our minds? Look at what they're doing. Look at the way they act. Look at the way their family is, instead of expressing understanding and warmth. Now, there may be multiple causes for these kinds of symptoms that I've listed here, and it may be that callousness is not the only thing, but is it possible? Isn't it true that callousness may be one of the issues at hand when we see some symptoms like this? And again, you can add to that list if you like. We'd ask at this point in the sermon, what causes callousness in people? What is it that causes callousness in people? I'll give you a quick list of things I've put down. Again, you can add to this. You might find other things that are frankly more important than these. But this one might suffice to start. The lawlessness of the world. Does that cause callousness when we see lawlessness all around us? Jesus Christ actually foretold a time that we believe probably is still yet in the future, when callousness would be a dominant characteristic of the world. Turn with me, if you would, to Matthew chapter 24, and we'll read in verse 12. You probably already know where we're going here. Matthew 24 and verse 12. Christ foretells of a time when callousness would be, I believe, a dominant characteristic in the culture around us, in the world as a whole. Now, I believe callousness runs in cycles. And there are times when the culture around us gets very hardened. And there are times when it's more malleable. I think we'll be entering a time of increasing callousness as we near the end of this age. Matthew 24 and verse 12. We'll draw this out of the context. Apologize, we can't read more of the section here. But it simply says this, "And because lawlessness will abound..." Lawlessness, King James says, iniquity would abound. Because lawlessness will abound, it says this, the love of many will grow cold. The love that normally would be in a human heart dissolves into hardness, into callousness. Like, I'm sorry for what you're going through, but look, I got my own stuff I'm dealing with. Don't have time to deal with you. Don't have time to worry about you. I've got my own things I'm dealing with. Lawlessness abounds, love grows cold. That's a warning, I'm sure, for us as well, brethren. To be sure that as the world around us gets increasingly lawless, that we are not affected by that as well. Turn over to Romans chapter 1. There's a parallel here in one sense, where it describes the lawlessness of the world. Paul here describes a bit of a process that has gone on and frankly continues to go on. Romans chapter 1 uses a specific word in Paul's list here of what happens to a world when they turn away from God's law and inhabit the area of lawlessness. Now, lawlessness, by the way, is not a complete disregard for law. Lawlessness, in many respects, is a disregard for God's law. Not necessarily all law. Some people still pay their taxes. Why? Because they'll go to jail if they don't. But they're immoral. They don't pay attention to God's law. They observe other laws. They still stop at stop signs. But God's law is rejected. So Paul is describing here, when God's law is set aside, what are the fruits that come from that? Romans chapter 1 and verse 28. Even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind. In Romans 1, 28. God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. So when it comes to spiritual law, they set that aside. They've removed God. They haven't removed law altogether. Don't make that mistake. Verse 29. But being filled, what happens when they set God's law aside? They are filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy. Of course, that never goes around at this time of year. You never see envy at all in advertising at this time of year. That's not a point at all. Murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, interesting, unloving. King James used to say, without natural affection. The kind of milk of human kindness seems to drain away. And again, this seems to go in cycles in the culture around us. Unloving, unforgiving, and unmerciful. When people all around us are that way, it is a challenge not to become like them. Not to treat them as you may be being treated. It's hard not to be calloused when you have this kind of behavior all around. We've said before, when we talk about this list being filled with all unrighteousness in verse 29, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness. I mean, how many times have we heard, as I've mentioned before, grandparents who know better now accepting immorality as if it's okay. Well, not much we can do about it. We get used to that. We become calloused to those things. How about a second thing? Besides lawlessness, a related issue is the desensitizing influence of this world. Does that make us calloused? Well, it sure does. When we, as a quick example, hear foul language over and over and over again in the entertainment we watch, is it true that at some point it doesn't affect us as much? I'm talking with a friend recently who's spent a lot of years out in the world, kind of apart from God's way. Sometimes the vocabulary is just shocking. And to bring it to the attention, to say, stop using that word. That word offends me. It just flows as if it's everyday speech, and it shouldn't be. But the desensitizing influence of this world can make it easy. Turn to 2 Timothy chapter 3. Isn't it true that in entertainment, or in the neighborhood, the word fornication has been lost to our vocabulary? Isn't that true? Sure has. And almost lost to our culture is the word adultery. It doesn't exist in our culture's mind anymore. And there are a number of others that we won't take the time to go through, but they just have disappeared because it's become so acceptable. So it is possible for us as well. You know, I refuse to say your spouse or your significant other. That's a bunch of malarkey. We shouldn't have to talk that way. It's either your spouse or it's your fornication partner. That's what it is. Let's be honest about this. It's either your spouse or your homosexual lover. That's what it is. Let's be honest about these things. Let's call it for what it is. I'm sorry that some might be offended by that, but that's simply what it is. It's either an honest person or a thief. It's not, well, I only steal sometimes. Okay, then you're a thief, right? I mean, let's be honest about these things. It can be desensitizing. We can simply go with the flow. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 1 through verse 5. But know this, that in the last days perilous or dangerous times will come. Why? For men will be lovers of themselves. Isn't that selfishness? When everybody around us is selfish, isn't it easy to take that trip too? Lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving. There that is again, without natural affection. Calloused, we might say. Unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good. When I think of without self-control, I always think of one of the members here who is now resting, awaiting the resurrection. Many from Cleveland would know him as well, Mr. Moore. He would drive from Cleveland. For some reason, he was attached to the Akron congregation. He would drive to Akron every Sabbath during the years he could. Sometimes with two legs, then later on with one leg, then later on with no legs, and he'd still have his hand control, still get to church somehow. But he used to explain to me how he would drive to church. He says, I always go 55, no matter what the speed limit is. Higher than that. But I get in the center lane, said people flying by me on both sides, but I'm in the center, so they can get around me either way. Now if it's me, and they're driving 70 all around me, I'm driving 70. I'm keeping up with them. Mr. Moore just right down there, never bothered by it. People beep at me and I wave as they go by, you know, just the way he was. Fine example. But he was with self-control. He's going to do this, not going to be influenced by others. Brutal. Verse 4, traitors, heady, haughty, I should say, headstrong, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. From such people, turn away. The word unloving, without natural affection, Moffat literally translates as calloused. One thing that often enters into us, when we talk about the desensitizing influence of the world, there's something I'd like to bring out kind of as a sub-point here that I find myself really concerned about with me, and it may be something you're dealing with as well. But when I think about this issue of callousness, and the desensitizing influence of the world, the us-them mentality, is really something that struck me recently. Because if it's someone in the church that's hurt, well, that's a terrible tragedy. Let's pray about that. If it's somebody who's not in the church, it's them. And what struck me recently was this whole thing in the Philippines. Because I found myself saying, oh, good, only one of our church members has had a difficulty. Ooh, that's wonderful. And yet thousands are dead. Many, many hundreds of thousands affected. Many thousands without houses. People of our faith in other groups having grave difficulties. And I've all of a sudden found myself, why am I not concerned about that the way I ought to be? Why did I immediately put them in the them category? No matter who it was, we had our one church member and then everybody else is in the them category. Why was that? That shouldn't be. And to realize that's not right. That's kind of the way the world does it. If it's a them, it's not that big a deal. If it's an us, wow, that's a big deal. I don't think Christ looks at things that way. Looked at this situation this way. See, I feel like I was measuring the tragedy by the number of us that were affected. Not by the real number affected, no matter where they might be in the world or in other groups or whatever it might be. So that was something that I really had to think about and pray about and frankly repent about and ask God to really help me with that. Maybe that's something you've seen as well. I've mentioned this before, 24-hour a day news services are a real curse to society because you've got to fill the air with something. And so you dredge up the worst of the worst from all around the world so that we can be fed that material 24 hours a day. That's really hard on us. It's hard to be a sensitive individual, a truly caring, compassionate individual when you have nothing but this kind of thing constantly being pumped out. I remember one person saying recently, you know I should watch world events, but I turned off the news because I just couldn't take it anymore. I thought that was an interesting approach. Not that I'm saying we shouldn't watch world events, but do we need to wash our minds constantly, day after day, hour after hour, with the worst of the worst? Is that necessary to watch world events? Maybe not. Maybe not quite to that level. What's another thing that can cause callousness in Christians? How about personal sin? Personal sin. Is it true that if we are involved with personal sin, that it's harder possibly to be compassionate toward others? Turn to Luke chapter 21. Luke 21. Now, this is not to say that we can be perfect and therefore without callousness. I don't think that's true in this life. Hopefully it will be one day. But it is not true that if we know of sin that we're not working on, that we're not striving to repent of. Is it possible that that hardens us? Luke 21 and verse 34, familiar with the parable here and then Christ's instruction, says, "Take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life." Our hearts can be weighed down. It goes on to say, "And that day come on you unexpectedly, for it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch, therefore, pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and stand before the Son of Man." Is our heart weighed down? The first two, I would say, sin. The third one, probably more just busyness. Fear. Worry, fretting. Carousing and drunkenness, probably sin involved with that, no doubt. Cares of this life, well, sin by extension, but too busy with the things of this world. Personal sin, carousing and drunkenness. Hard to say we're very compassionate toward others if we're drunk. Pretty simple. Turn over to Mark chapter 3. Christ actually was upset in this account in the book of Mark with the individuals who seem to have no compassion whatsoever. Now, we assume it was Pharisees, because they're mentioned a little bit later. It may have been others as well. It might have been Sadducees in with this as well. But Christ literally was angry with them because of their callousness. Mark 3 and verse 1, "He entered the synagogue again, and a man was there who had a withered hand. So they," these religious leaders, Pharisees more specifically, "so they watched him closely, whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so they might accuse him." Can you imagine the hardness of heart these Pharisees had? Could care less about the guy with the withered hand. What was their attitude? Glad it's not me. Yeah, sorry, he's got it, but you know. Probably something his parents did, some sin they committed. Maybe some sin he committed. Therefore, he's got this malady. Talk about callous, hard, insensitive. So they watched to see if Christ would heal. Now again, talk about callousness spiritually there. Who could heal like this? Nobody. Wouldn't you want to promote this? Hey, there's somebody in our nation that can actually heal people. Do miraculous things. Wouldn't you want that? Well, apparently it was a threat to them. Verse 3, "He said to the man who had the withered hand, step forward." He knew. Christ knew what they were thinking. Verse 4, "He said to them," these Pharisees, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" But they kept silent. Well, I don't know what the answer to that one is. Now, obviously, they couldn't save life on the Sabbath or any other day. They couldn't heal. Well, they could kill, but you see, we weren't supposed to go to war on a Sabbath if you didn't have to. Verse 5, when he looked around at them with anger. Angry because of their callousness and their other attitudes involved. Being grieved by the hardness of their hearts. He said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out. His hand was restored as whole as the other. Then the Pharisees went out and immediately plotted with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him. Talk about callousness. Talk about hardness of heart. Their sin shielded their hearts from compassion, from sensitivity, from really caring for this individual. So instead of caring for this person, rejoicing with him that he'd healed, been healed, they were looking out a way to kill. One other scripture in this regard, Hebrews 3. Hebrews 3 and verse 12. Hebrews 3 and verse 12. We'll read verses 12 and verse 13. Paul talks about here this concept of hardness of heart. Draws the example of Israel and how they were hardened. Hardness of heart. Calloused heart, we might say. It says, "Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God." Wow, he's warning the brethren. An evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God, "but exhort one of the daily watch, call today, lest any of you be hardened." Hardened how? Through the deceitfulness of sin. Personal sin can cause us to be heartless. When we are sensitive to our own sin, we can be more sensitive to the needs and the sufferings of others. There is a quick fourth one we'll throw in here as well. A fourth reason, now again, you can certainly add others to this, we won't for time. I think a fourth cause of callousness is fatigue, where we are just worn out. As I mentioned earlier, 24-hour-a-day news can tire us. That it's one horrible thing after another. And because it can be reported from anywhere in the world at any time. I mean, how many of us really listen to some of these news reports about what happened in Egypt last week or 2 weeks ago and how many were killed? I mean, after a while, it just becomes, wow, I'm just tired of listening to all this stuff. I can't extend. I mean, there's a very clear studies done on compassion fatigue, where it's just, I can't feel anymore. It's just overwhelming. There's so much. Exhaustion can cause us, frankly, just not to care. Just not to care. We're so tired that our ability to care for others is just overwhelmed. So compassion fatigue can be a real enemy of God's people today because the world is in such bad shape. So many troubles. So we can see what causes callousness. Can we ask what's the antidote? If this is the case, and maybe as you go through this, well, no, that none of these things really have applied to me. So that's good. That's wonderful. I'm glad that's the case. But for some of us that may struggle with some of these things, what is the antidote to callousness? We'll simply say one word to begin, and that is compassion. Compassion. Now, it's easy to say. Oh, if you're callous, just have compassion. Well, that's nice, but I'm calloused. So, how do we go about this? Turn to Matthew chapter 23. Compassion is defined this way. Deep awareness of the suffering of another. Deep awareness of the suffering of another. But that's not where it stops. Deep awareness of the suffering of another. The definition continues saying this. Coupled with the wish to relieve it. See, anybody can see the suffering of others, but to have a deep awareness of it, to in a sense stand in their shoes, is a rare quality. Coupled with the wish to relieve it. Webster's College Dictionary says this, a feeling of deep sympathy and sorrow for someone struck by misfortune, but accompanied by a desire to alleviate the suffering. You see, compassion is not just feeling badly for someone, But it's feeling badly in the sense that we want to change what they're going through. We want to help them through that. A compassionate person is action-oriented. So when we say what's the antidote for callousness of heart, it is compassion that does something. It is action. We'll talk more about that in a few moments. Matthew 23. Matthew chapter 23, beginning in verse 37. Here's the example of Jesus Christ. God is often called in the Psalms the God of compassion. Matthew 23, verse 37. O Jerusalem, Christ says, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. Now, personally, I think Christ was in one of those frames of mind where it was resolve at this point. Jerusalem. I don't think he was angry. I don't think he was shaking his finger at them. He was more like, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often, he says, I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. This isn't said in anger or shaking the finger. This is resolve. It's kind of resigned to this. Like, why are you doing this? I would like to have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings for protection, for safety. But you were not willing. So, verse 38, see, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. He's resolved. He's resigned to the fact that they're going to have to suffer because of their rebellion. Because of their resistance to God and His law and His truth and His way. Because of their stubbornness. Because of their hard-heartedness. They're just going to have to go through this. But he wasn't relishing it. He's rather sad about it. Now, I don't know, but for me, it's a little bit challenging to look at the world and say, you know, I'd like to gather you under way. I should feel this way. I want to feel that way. Got some ways to go. Turn back a few pages to Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9. I think that's part of the us-them mentality once again. Well, they're in the world, no wonder. And sometimes it may be easy for Christians to shut off sympathy or compassion to the world, well, because they're the world. And they haven't repented yet. And they're out there being in rebellion to God. So the God of authority and power is going to deal with them. And yet you have Christ almost weeping over the city, saying, I just want to tenderly gather you. You just wouldn't do it. You just wouldn't cooperate. How sad you're going to have to go through what you'll go through. Matthew chapter 9, verse 35, Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom. We've talked about that in the past. And healing every sickness and every disease among the people. Why would he do that if he didn't care? Did he do that just to show who he was? Look at me, I can heal? No. How do we know that? Because verse 36, when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them. He's moved with compassion for them because they were weary and scattered, like sheep having no shepherd. Weary and scattered. Does that describe our world today? It's hard sometimes to have compassion for those faceless millions out there who are of the world. You see, it's easier for us if we segment things. Okay, I can have compassion for my wife, for my kids, for my husband and my kids, my parents. I can have compassion for my grandparents or my grandkids, or I can have compassion for my neighbors. These are close by. This is a small segment, but I get us much beyond. Okay, I can have compassion for my brethren, but we get much beyond that and we start to lose it. It's just all those nameless people. Yet Christ looked at this mass of people and just felt this compassion because they're just lost. These people are lost. So again, sometimes we've tended to look at others and say, well, they're the world. They're getting what they deserve. They're rebelling against God. Well, Christ could have said that as well. And he did say, look, there's going to be trouble that comes because of their stubbornness, because of their rebellion. But he truly does not want to see that have to happen. That's the sense I get. He was moved with compassion. So as a result, we ask the question too, brethren, do we have the same motivation for the prayers that we give that Christ did? Christ is going to ask to pray for more laborers. Why did He ask for more laborers? Because He had deep compassion for the lost. You see, He had compassion for them. He was moved. He was emotional about this because they were lost. They were wearied and scattered. And as a result of that, He said, pray to the Lord of the harvest. Verse 37, He said to the disciples, the harvest is truly plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into His harvest. Christ, in essence, was saying, I'd like to see a lot of these people harvested. It gives us motivation to preach the gospel, does it not? Not just to warn the world, but because we want to see people harvested. We want to see their lives improve. Why? Because we have compassion on them. We see them wandering. Again, this gives us confidence to teach God's way because we really do have the answers. We have the answers to their suffering, to their heartache, to their difficulties. God's way is the answer. It is the only answer. So it can move us with compassion. When we look out there and we see the news reports or we see the city or we see the area and they're just lost. They're weary and scattered. Some of them are angry and mean and ill-tempered, absolutely. But it's because they're lost. So compassion is the answer. What goes hand in hand with compassion? We intimated this a little earlier. It is service. The antidote to callousness is compassion and service. Turn with me to Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10. I think it's interesting. You wonder sometimes why certain things are the way they are. What is interesting is Luke is the only one that records this story, this parable, in his gospel. Matthew does not, Mark does not. Luke does, John does not. Can't help but wonder why. Don't have a good answer for that, but I wonder if Luke, because of his possible Gentile background, wanted to include this story. And it is probably one of the most famous Bible stories ever. The parable of the Good Samaritan. Luke chapter 10, verse 25. Now, what I'd like to challenge us all to do as we read through this is to put this in modern context today. Now, we all know that it could be taken personally. Okay, I need to do these kinds of things. But as we read through this, I'd also like to think about this concept that we've been discussing of our responsibility to teach the truth to others. Can we look at this in that light as well? Luke chapter 10, beginning in verse 25. Behold, a certain lawyer stood up and tested him. There was a test going on here. Challenge, in one sense, we might say. Teacher, in other words, it wasn't that this individual really wanted to know the answer. He was testing Christ to see if Christ could come up with the right answer, at least the answer that the lawyer felt he should come up with. What shall I do to inherit eternal life? And Christ said to him, verse 26, what is written in the law? What is your reading of it? We said before, Christ often answered questions with questions, turned the tables to get at the heart of what was in the other person's heart. So he answered and said, I'm sure quite proudly, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. Virtually quotes the scripture from memory. Pretty impressive feat. Christ simply said to him, verse 28, you have answered rightly. Good answer. And then he adds the kicker. Do this, and you will live. Not enough to know it is what Christ was saying. You know this, but you're not doing it, in essence, is what he's saying. Do this, and you will live. But he understood exactly what Christ said. He understood that this was Christ correcting him in public. And so he said, wanting to justify himself, He knew he wasn't doing these things. Everybody else knew he wasn't doing these things. And he wanted to save some face. So he wanted to justify himself, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Na, 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 poo, poo. Think you trapped me? Who's my neighbor? And then Christ tells this story. We could certainly say that one of the aspects of this story is the incredible compassion that the Samaritan expresses. Jesus answered and said, "A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho." You've heard before that this road, during that age, was particularly dangerous place oftentimes. Thieves had many places to hide and attack as people traveled through these two areas. He fell among thieves who stripped him of his clothing, wounded him, basically beat the living daylights out of him, and departed, leaving him half dead. Verse 31. Now by chance, a certain priest came down that road. Now, I don't know, but I wonder if there were not priests in the audience, and that Christ was likewise publicly correcting them. If he wasn't, he certainly made it pretty clear that he was not pleased with the priest class in general. When he saw him lying there, he passed by on the other side. Now we could say, as we have in the past, speculated many reasons as to why this could be the case. What was the reason? He didn't care. We know that. Or we could say, well, he's going to the temple, and if he touched the dead body or something, he couldn't be there. If he touched blood, then he'd have to, blah, 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 blah. The point is, he didn't care. At least care enough to pay any attention to this person. He was calloused, spiritually, certainly, and maybe physically as well. Likewise, verse 32, a Levite, when he arrived at the place, came and looked and passed by on the other side. So, at least for the Levite, there seems to have been a pause to stop and look. Is the guy breathing? Is he not? Maybe he saw him breathe, so he's still alive. I'm going on. I don't know. Why did he go on? Because he didn't care. Simple enough. Just didn't care. Or at least care enough. Not my problem. Maybe he was desensitized. Maybe there were people on that road often that were sick and hurt or beat. Maybe there were other indications. We don't know. Point is, he did not have compassion. Therefore, they weren't going to serve. Wasn't going to help. Verse 33, but a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. Now, we could say compassion is built through our prayer, through our Bible study, through our help of others, through our lots of ways it can be built, I'm sure. But he had compassion. What's it indicating? The other two did not. They did not have compassion. They were callous. They were hard. They didn't care. When we preach the gospel as an organization, it's because we care about the world. Not because we just want to witness to them. Why do we witness the world? Because we care about them. That's why the witness goes out. Witnessing to the world and making disciples, the same motivation has to be at the core of both of those. It's care for the world. It's care for the ones that God has created. When he saw him, he had compassion. Why did he have compassion? He's another human being. Didn't care who he was. Somehow, the Samaritan was able to put himself into the shoes of the individual lying on the road. He said, wow, if that were me, I sure would want somebody to help me. If I were completely lost spiritually, I'd want somebody to tell me at some point, say, hey, have you thought about this? Have you considered this? Do you realize this is right and what you're doing is wrong? Verse 34, so he went to him, bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Sometimes we could do that literally. Many times we do that figuratively. When we teach others the truth, when we share with them what is most important to us, that is God's way of life, the reason we exist, when we can help others understand that, it is like bandaging wounds and pouring on oil and wine. Will they come to conversion now? Maybe not. But don't we have that responsibility? Pouring on oil and wine. Set him on his own animal, brought him to an inn and took care of him. Because he cared about him. Boy, if we're going to teach others the truth, will it not first come from our compassion? The compassion of God's Spirit that wells up within us. Verse 35, on the next day, when he departed, he took out 2 denarii, gave them to the innkeeper and said to him, take care of him. And whatever more you spend, when I come again, I will repay you. That is absolutely astounding. Try to put myself in that position and say, I don't know that I would be there. Verse 36, Christ then gives the kicker to the lawyer. So which of these three do you think was neighbor to him who fell among the thieves? Boy, this really would have made this lawyer uncomfortable. Because number one, it shows I have to do something. Number two, I have to admit that a Samaritan, a vile, filthy Samaritan, one-upped both the priest and the Levite. It was a tough pill to swallow. Which of these was neighbor? You asked, who's your neighbor? Which of these was neighbor to him who fell among thieves? Verse 37. And he said, he couldn't even say the word, Samaritan. He who showed mercy on him. Then Jesus said, go and do likewise. Go and do likewise. The solution to callousness, obviously, for Christians is to develop compassion through service. That way, when we have the opportunity to teach others who need the truth, when we have the opportunity to do so, we have the compassion that motivates that. We have the desire to do it because we really want this person to understand. We really want their lives to be better. We don't want to have to see them suffer. We really want to give them something of value. We feel like Peter in those situations, do we not? Silver and gold have I none, but what I have, I'm happy to give you. I'm not hiding what I have to give you. I'm happy to give it to you because it is the answer. It's what you need. We give it with confidence because there's love and compassion there that motivates us. Turn finally to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. Maybe after all, there is a good bit of truth in the saying, people need to know how much you care before they care how much you know. That probably is true. So where do we start? Where do we start? We know we probably have built up some callousness here or there. Sometimes, without even knowing it, might be there. Maybe it's from way in the past. Maybe it's more recent times, some of the things that influenced us, as we've mentioned. But where do we start? I would suggest as we close that we start with each other. 1 Peter chapter 3 in verse 8. 1 Peter 3 in verse 8. When I say start with each other, is it not true that the Scriptures say by their fruits you will know them? That the church of God will be known by its what? Love for one another. They'll see this community in the church of God caring for each other, providing for each other, looking out for each other, and it will be a tremendous witness in today's world that, boy, there's something very special about this group of people. They really do love each other. They really do take care of each other. 1 Peter 3, verse 8, finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another. Don't worry about the guy laying in the street and the Samaritan stopping. We've got plenty here to begin with, don't we? Don't we? We sure do. Having compassion for one another. Love as brothers. It's my conviction that when the church of God gets this together, the teaching of the world is going to come pretty easy. We've got to start somewhere. We've got to start at home. That may mean literally in our own homes. It may be extended to the church family. But this is where we begin. Having compassion on one another, for one another. Love as brothers. Compassion, again, motivates us to service. Love as brothers. Be tender-hearted. Be courteous. Not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, blessing, knowing that you were called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. Now, I don't know for sure, but Peter's talking to the church. He talks to wives early in the chapter. He talks to husbands. So I have an inkling that when he says, verse 9, not returning evil for evil, reviling for reviling, he's talking about in the church. It's pretty obvious outside the church that people are going to be doing evil to us from time to time. They'll revile us from time to time. But isn't it a much more difficult one that happens within the family? So maybe that's what Peter's talking about. But nonetheless, he says, have compassion on one another, for one another. Love as brothers, be tender-hearted. So when we begin to try to overcome callousness, we start at home. We start with the family of God. And as we do that, we will be prepared to teach others because we will be soft of heart. We will see where change needs to take place in others, and we'll be able to help them to do so. Brethren, we live amongst a culture that is often quite calloused to the hurt and the suffering of others. To effectively teach the truth in the future, let us work on developing a heart of compassion so that we might be of true help and service to the world who so desperately needs it.